Contoso wants to do this. All right, Contoso wants to really lift their game and, you know, grow explosively. And so, of course, everyone's looking to Luis to say, you know, are you confident that this platform that you've built is going to be able to deal with the load? Are you confident that we're not going to have outages during peak periods? So what this experience is about, story A of this experience, is about thinking of what approaches, what patterns do we take to various challenges in the cloud around availability, scalability, dealing with latency, and so forth. So we're going to talk about things like caching. We're going to talk about things like using the CDN. As I said earlier in the day, you know, we're now at the point in IT where we can literally build applications that are architected such that they will never go down. Right? And that's a very bold statement to make. Given recent events, that probably means thinking about building cross-cloud applications that maybe run a bit on-premise and run in the cloud. You know, we have seen some global cloud outages lately, but it is possible to build applications that never go down. We just need to think about the patterns that help make that possible. And I'm not saying that Contoso is never going to go down, but we're going to use Contoso to talk about some of these cloud architecture patterns. So the first thing we think about with the cloud is sort of scalability and throughput, right? So if we think about how we deal with a need for more throughput in on-premises scenarios, we've traditionally done that by buying a bigger server, right? You know, scale on-prem has traditionally been scale up. Too slow? Go see the business owner. You need a bigger server. Here's the purchase order, right? Bigger server. Problem solved. That is possible in the cloud. We can scale up in the cloud. The cloud is not designed to take that architectural approach for a couple of reasons. One is that a lot of cloud applications are far too big to think about scaling up on one server. Another is that there are diseconomies to scale. The example I give is that a single rack server with one CPU, right, versus a massive server with 64 CPUs, that massive server is more than 64 times the price of our 1U server. As we start to get really big, the number of vendors who we can buy from gets really small. The number of servers, the types of servers we can buy gets really small. There are diseconomies of scale. The cloud is all about economies of scale. The cloud is built for scale out rather than scale up. And the thing with scale out is, as soon as you go from it runs on one server to it runs on two servers, as long as you've done your job properly, running on two servers is as complex as running on 20 servers. It's as complex as running on 200 servers. Wherever possible, you should endeavor to use the smallest machines you can get away with. Now, on Azure, that means using smalls or mediums. It doesn't mean using extra smalls. Extra small is a completely separate use case. Extra small, don't use that for applications that need to scale. Extra small is great for, like, I've got some tasks that need to run in the background. Give me a cheap machine. Right. There are additional benefits when we think about using scale out rather than scale up. The first is that we are buying our capacity in much smaller increments. If we think about how we scale up in Azure, we have small, then we have medium, which is roughly twice the cost of small. Then we have large, which is roughly twice the cost of medium, four times the cost of small. Then we have extra large, twice the cost of large, four times the cost of medium, eight times the cost of small. Those jumps start to get quite big in terms of how much we have to pay. Contrast that with scaling out, say using small or medium instances. As we need more capacity, we just add one more instance. So it's much easier for us to right size our capacity. It also means that if we lose one machine, we've only lost a fraction of what we've got deployed. So the next thing to think about is how we deal with scale in our app tier. Because actually applications deal with a huge spectrum of scale these days. We have some situations where the thing we're most focused on is density, right? It's multi-tenanted. How many customers can we cram into one machine? Right? And I think that's going to become a really hot topic soon with all these microservices and things. A lot of those are going to really help us achieve massive tenant density on one machine. So that's one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, we've got situations where we've got one tenant or one application, and it has to spread out across multiple machines. And so when we think about our architectures, we want to think about how can we build an architecture that is able to deal with both of those ends of the spectrum potentially. Because we may have situations, say you're a software as a service ISV, where actually you do have that scenario, where you sell your service and some customers are tiny and you want to push lots of them onto one machine, or maybe they're your trial customers. And some customers are so large that they need to span across multiple machines. So however you architect your application, you need to think about how can I deal with both dense scenarios and large scale scenarios. So what are some of the things that Contoso needs to change to account for this? Exactly right. Contoso don't need to change anything. Right? Why? Well, because Azure Mobile Services, that's a multi-tenanted platform. It supports high density. We can run multiple sites on a single instance. It also supports running one site across multiple instances. So obviously, Azure Web, our API management, scales, mobile services, scales. Our orders app, we're deploying on reasonably small instances, and we've scaled that out already for availability reasons. The database is a sharp edge, so we probably need to come back and talk about that soon too. Before we get there, let's talk a little bit about integration. So integration's interesting because when we think about scaling integration, we're potentially scaling two sides of that bridge. And we have to be pretty careful, as we sort of talked about earlier. You know, if you scale up massively on the sender and you're connected directly onto the receiver, you have the potential to perform denial of service on that receiver. And I have seen instances of this where customers have deployed applications in the cloud, turned on auto scale, and broken their on-premises systems, like mission critical line of business systems. So, you know, there'll be situations where we need to scale that receiver, and we've got a few options there. We can scale that receiver just by adding more instances, or we can think about using queues to help to buffer. And that's what we've done earlier. Right? The benefit of queues do not get you any more throughput. Right? What queues do is help you to smooth your traffic. And any time in cloud architecture, any time you can get away with an asynchronous pattern, you should do that, because what that lets you do is scale different parts of your application independently. So it gives you a way to manage your costs, it gives you a way to manage your availability and performance independently in the different parts of your application. We built it right the first time. They're using queuing here already, right? So we use service bus queues in the Contoso application, right, to buffer through BizTalk services to our on-premises ERP. Now with BizTalk services, we scale by buying scale units. So we need to provision a certain level of throughput. And we do that by specifying scale units. We use the queue to make sure that if we exceed our provision throughput, we just buffer into the queue and then we flush the queue out. Obviously, if you do not have enough throughput provisioned, your queue will just keep getting longer. So you need to monitor your queues. Right? So it's all about smoothing. It does not buy you more throughput. It just protects you by giving you a buffer to write into. So the hard part is, of course, the data tier, right? The data tier, we kind of have to scale up. Well, in terms of relational, we have to scale up. If we want to keep the nice properties of relational databases, right? Global transactions, locks, isolation levels, atomic, consistent, isolated, durable transactions. Right? These are all things we take for granted in relational. One way to solve that problem is to say, I don't need any of those. I'll go and use a NoSQL database. And so it's like, okay, no more transactions for you, you know, or okay, no more consistency for you, right? NoSQL gives up some of the characteristics that we take for granted to help solve some of these problems, because NoSQL scales by distributing the database across multiple nodes and usually distributing your data by sharding it across those multiple nodes. At a high level, if we want to scale our data tier beyond what we can achieve with a single node and scale up, we need some sort of sharding pattern. Typically, that's going to be a horizontal sharding pattern, right? And what we'll usually be looking for are boundaries of transactions. So if we think about Contoso Coffee, a transaction doesn't usually, it potentially involves multiple different types of coffee, right? Lattes, espressos. It probably doesn't involve multiple customers. One transaction is usually for one customer, and this is a very common pattern, right? The customer forms the isolation boundary, and therefore we shard our data by customer. Now we can get more sophisticated than that, so we could shard our data by customer, but actually instead of using the customer's name or some other identifier for it, we could potentially use the customer's geographical location. As long as we've got roughly equal sized groups of customers, that then gives us the potential to maybe start moving read-only copies of our data around different geographies in the world. Getting maybe a bit too complex there. But the common pattern is once we hit a scale limit, scaling up, we need to shard. Right? This is what NoSQL databases do. We can shard a relational database. We do lose that ability to do global transactions. You could do global transactions. You could run an IaaS, and you could do distributed transactions. But distributed transactions require distributed locks, and locks do not scale. Right? You know, you do, as you scale out to multiple nodes, you do not want those nodes sharing locks, right? Because it just ain't going to scale. So we need to think about, you know, how do we deal with that? How do we deal with the fact that we can't have global transactions and so forth? We did for that sort of that ticketing scenario, the sports ticketing scenario. You think about massive event goes on sale. We just chop the football stadium up into areas, give each area its own database, sell in that database, 50 or 100 or so databases. And then when all the tickets are sold, turn them all back into one database. Right. Really good example of elastic scale at the data tier. And how do we shard it? We shard it by physical areas of the stadium. Why is that a good pattern? Well, when you go to the stadium, right, and you buy some seats, you want to be sitting in the same part of the stadium as your friends. Right? You don't want to be sitting with, I'm sitting here and there's a walkway and my friend's sitting there. We don't sell tickets like that. We sell tickets in sections of the stadium. Therefore, that's our transaction boundary. Therefore, that's great for sharding. So you can always find these nice, or you can usually find these nice natural transaction boundaries. What are the hard bits? It means if we want to know how many tickets do we have left to sell, we have to go around and have a look at 100 databases to see how many tickets we've got left to sell. So you have to have different approaches, maybe something working in the background to do that. So at Contoso, we're not scaling out our data tier at the moment. The places where we may need to do that, the databases. You know, I think realistically, if we had to do that, we may well look at a NoSQL data store behind our mobile service. Okay, what else do we need to think about? We need to think about latency. So now that we've sort of all bought into this idea of the cloud, and we're now running our workloads instead of being next door in our server room on the local area network, they are 80 milliseconds away. Where's closer for you? San Antonio? Mm-hmm. In San Antonio, we have latency. We have to deal with latency. We've spoken a bit about latency already today, right? Because again, bandwidth has got better on the internet. Latency has not got better as quickly. Latency won't get better as quickly because we can't change the speed of light. Approaches that we've talked about today to deal with latency, those script and style.render commands, they're actually all about latency. Why are they about latency? Well, because by taking 20 CSS files and turning them into one, we make one 80 millisecond round trip to Texas, not 20 round trips to Texas. So, other ways that we can help with latency. The first is to use the CDN. Right? I spoke earlier about this idea that there's a whole lot of stuff in Azure. There are like these little things you can pluck out and use in almost any app. The CDN is something in Azure that you can use in almost any app. Right? The CDN is all about caching data that's accessed by browsers, accessed over HTTP, out to the edges of the network. Right? So it's pushing it to data centers all over the world so that when I, as a browser, go to www.contoso.com, if I'm here in Mexico City, I'll probably fetch it from a CDN node. Francisco, do you know if you have a CDN node here in Mexico City? Do you have a CDN node here? Yep. Yeah? I fix it. I first go to the CDN node here in Mexico City. Have you got that picture? No. Okay. Go get it from Texas. Okay, comes back. Right, put it there. Next time I get it again, right, I pick it up from that local store. So what it does is it pushes our content out closer to our users, so it's on a lower latency connection. And the nice thing about the Azure CDN is that you can use it with existing apps. You can use it across the top of blob storage. You can use it across the top of your websites. You can use it across the top of stuff that you're running elsewhere. It really is, you know, something that you can just pick up and start using today. So, CDN, super useful for Contoso. Pretty simple. Turn it on. All right. Okay, next thing. We can start to get even more clever, right? So we could start to think about, instead of just using the CDN, what if we could architect our application so that we can geographically distribute the application? So instead of scaling out to multiple servers all running in Texas, we actually scale out to servers, some of which are in Texas, some of which are in Singapore, some of which are in, say, Ireland. Right? And our users get routed using Azure Traffic Manager to the nearest deployment of the application. This is hard. In orders of magnitude over the CDN, this is probably 1,000 times harder than just using the CDN. Why? Well, because usually our application has some state, some data. And what do we know about dealing with data? It's really hard once we start trying to distribute it. Right? We start giving up some of those things we really want, like, you know, transactional consistency and so forth. You know, and again, we could go deep on some of that sort of stuff. Some customers may want to deep dive on distributed databases. The next thing we could do is use a cache. The number of applications that I see that don't use caching. Often I get called up by customers, you know, help, our application is going really, really slow. Can you come and tell us why? There are two tools in my kit bag that usually help me fix that problem. The first is caching. The second is showing them how to tune SQL Server queries. Caching is really important. Caching is really easy. Caching is really cheap. Caching will save you a lot of money. Right? Why will it save you a lot of money? If we're hitting the cache, we're not hitting the database server. The database server, A, is expensive to buy, and B, if we scale it up and hit a limit, it's very expensive to architect around that problem. What does the cache do? It lets us take a whole lot of load off that database server. What's the usual customer problem with caching? They complain, they say, my application's real time. All right? I can't afford for data to be out of date. People hear that from customers? When they say that, you say, okay, so it's a browser-based application, and it's probably 2,000 to 5,000 milliseconds of round trip and render before your customer who sent the request actually gets something on the screen. So if I cache data for a few seconds, is that data really out of date? Okay, when you put it that way, probably not. Okay. If you were doing 1,000 requests per second against your SQL server, and I'm caching for a few seconds, I've just saved you a lot of money. Every application should have caching enabled. Right? Even if you turn it off, write it, build it. It's super easy to add. If you're building a data abstraction layer, right, some sort of data access layer, put caching in it. Use Redis cache. Right, that is the gold standard for caching in Windows. Redis is exceedingly scalable. So, super simple for Contoso to enable caching on their mobile service, but actually there's caching elsewhere already. So API management supports caching. Right? Because again, API is a great place. If you've got calls to the API, right, with common parameters, and that they don't rely on the user's identity, that's very cacheable data. So a great place to cache that is here in API management. Take the load off the orders API, take the load off your SQL database, and so forth. Okay, last couple to talk about. We've already spoken about Express Route. And the last one is sort of the idea of using replicas. A good example here would be things like SQL Server. So Windows Azure SQL Database and SQL Server availability groups have this concept of read-only replicas. Read-only replicas in different geographies. You can architect your application to take advantage of that, so to actually read data from those replicas in a different geography. This can give you a whole lot of benefits. My one word of caution that I would give you is that database replicas can very quickly turn into a very, very expensive cache. Right? If you can solve the problem with caching, it's often preferable to do that before you go all the way to a full database replica. Because if all the database replica is doing is being a cache, it can get very expensive. but we can build sort of very sophisticated and particularly high availability architectures by using read-only replicas. So a good example there would be my primary application is in San Antonio. I have a read-only replica running in Sao Paulo. If I have a failure in San Antonio, I can use Azure Traffic Manager to fail over to Sao Paulo, and my application runs in read-only mode until Texas comes back up. So that's all about how we deal with failure. We're going to talk about that shortly. So what do we need to do here? We've already got Express Route turned on. In terms of dealing with asynchronous latency, right? When we push data into the queue, latency kind of is a slightly different concept. Latency in asynchronous land is, once I've put the message on the queue, how long till it gets processed? Right. There's a few patterns here. One is best efforts. We'll deploy some machines, and there's no guarantees, but you know, we're pretty sure we'll get through the queue as quickly as we can. That's not a bad approach for some scenarios, right? You know, if you're happy enough that something sits in a queue for a few hours, right, taking this approach can let you run a very lean amount of resource at the receiver end. May not work for everybody. You may want a reserve level of capacity. Okay, we have enough capacity deployed that we know that we can process 5,000 requests per hour. And if you put more than 5,000 requests per hour into the queue, it'll buffer. And if you do 1,000 requests per hour, we've got a whole lot of stuff there sitting wasted. Reserve capacity is okay. You will waste money. The last approach is to think about some sort of automatic scaling, where we actually provide some targets. You know, we aim to process every message in the queue within 3 minutes. We provide some effectively failure levels. If a message is in the queue for more than 10 minutes, it's a failure state, and alert someone. And then within those thresholds, we aim to raise and lower the level of deployed capacity to deal with the length of the queue. And things we'll be looking at, things like queue length, things like how old is the oldest message in the queue. But other things that you need to look at, so that I call those, and I've actually, there's a white paper somewhere that I wrote on automatic scaling, right? Because I call those first derivative, or first sort of primary measures, right? So how long is my queue? That's a primary measure, right? Mm-hmm. What if we start taking derivative measures, right? So the first derivative, how quickly is my queue filling? It's speed, right? I'm thinking, if we think back to physics, right? Speed. How fast is my queue filling? What about taking a second derivative? Acceleration. Okay, my queue is filling, but it's not filling at a constant speed. It's filling at an accelerating speed. I'll turn on quite a bit of capacity. My queue is filling, but it's actually filling at a decelerating speed. Okay, I've got the problem under control, and it's going to come back down. Right. There are auto-scale mechanisms provisioned in Azure and those sorts of things. If you are auto-scaling in a massive application, I strongly believe that there is value in building quite sophisticated auto-scaling logic that looks at primary measures, first derivative, second derivative measures to make sure you are as efficient as possible when you add and remove capacity and make sure that you're not massively overshooting things. So at the moment, we are using the free tier. So we could jump in and actually turn that on to use a dedicated level of capacity. The nice thing with the dedicated capacity is that we can run multiple sites across one set of capacity. So if we choose to upgrade to S1, and again, you may find that this has been done in your environment before. I'm just not sure whether we're resetting this at the moment. Okay, so we've now changed ourselves to be using the standard pricing tier. What that's then going to let us do is to scale our application, and I think that may need a refresh. So the new portal's not in production yet. So if stuff's broken, that's why. Okay, so here's scale. At the moment we have auto scale off. We can turn auto scale on. And that's basically going to allow us to scale our website, so the number of machines sitting behind our website, based on the CPU percentage, right? So if we're inside 60 to 80%, right? We're happy. If we go outside that, we're going to add capacity until we get back inside that. Likewise, if we drop underneath it, we're going to remove capacity until we get back inside it. We can set a range of instances, so we can say, you know, we'd be prepared to scale up to say 3. Yeah? Save that. Be careful here, because this has the potential to give you a big bill. Now we're actually going to go and test this soon. So we are going to set an abnormally low scale threshold. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to whiz this down. So I'm going to set the threshold down at 3%. All right. So this is abnormally low, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and force it to scale. So what's the best way for me to try and force my website to scale? It's probably to get all of you to go into your browser and press refresh, 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 yeah? You can be like my web test team. Or it's to do some sort of load test. All right, so the other option is we could actually load test this. So if we open Visual Studio, the ideal tool for load testing a website is something where we can spin up a huge amount of capacity for a very short period of time. Does anybody know of something like that? Azure. Perfect, right? The cloud is ideally suited to load testing apps. Even if those apps are your on-premise apps, if you want to load test them, Azure is a great place to do that. Visual Studio supports running load tests out of Azure really easily. So what are we going to do? If we sign in, this may have signed in already. So what we're doing is signing in here. And that means it's going to sign into our Azure account. Great. So what we're using is Visual Studio Online, right, to run our load tests. So here we're signing in and accessing, connecting to Visual Studio Online for this immersion pod. And so that's going to provide us access to this cloud-hosted load testing. In here, I've got some web tests, right? So I've defined some web tests that take us through the buy process of our app. Now, this is pretty cool, right? Because if you think about what a typical load test is, it's like, okay, the browser goes to this page, then the browser goes to that page, and then the browser goes to that page. But our Contoso app is a single page app, right? So you can see actually what's going on here is this load test does some web calls, but it also picked up that there are some mobile services calls here. So it's allowing us to load test even our modern, sophisticated app. So if we jump in here and update this to 08, and this to 08, just to make sure we're hitting the right services. So here's our load test. So our load test is going to use that web test, right, and simulate the load of a whole bunch of users, right? So at the moment, we're just going to simulate 5 users. It can get really scary if you stand up a whole lot of users in terms of what the cost is. Tell it we want it to use the cloud. And then run our load test. So this is going to go off to Visual Studio Online, stand up the load test agents, and hammer our website. If we jump back into Internet Explorer, we'll be able to see that happening. We'll come back and actually look at those results after we've gone through this next whiteboard.
Are you using Visual Studio Online? Or?
Yeah, this is using Visual Studio Online. Yeah. Everyone using Visual Studio Online? Yeah? We use it a lot in my business. Every new project, every new client, stand up Visual Studio Online, right? There's your Visual Studio Online. Every one of our clients, you make them have Visual Studio Online. Only way to run projects. Let's talk about availability. Okay. Availability, keeping our system running. In a cloud-based application, we have dependencies usually on a number of external systems. We need to think about how we deal with those failures. The first type of failure we like to encounter is what we call a transient fault, right? We're relying on some other system, maybe it's a database, maybe it's some other service. It's got an outage. It could be only for a few milliseconds. It could be for a few seconds. What we need to do is we need to retry. But we need to retry intelligently, because if we're a really big application, and we've got a whole lot of users hitting us, that service goes down, and we have retry logic, okay, we're getting 1,000 requests per second, it's gone down. Right, so we'll retry in 1 second. Cool, so there's 1,000 requests per second, delayed a second. Meanwhile, we're still getting 1,000 requests per second, so in the next second, we get 2,000 requests, right? And they're gonna delay a second. And the first lot have just retried, and they're gonna delay a second. Okay, so next time around, there's 3,000 requests per second, and we are just piling on top of this server. So we need to have smart retry logic. We should retry. If it doesn't work, we should back off, right? Retry again, back off, right? We should include some randomness into this so that we don't end up with a whole lot of simultaneous retries going at this external service. Sometimes that service is having a significant failure. Right? And so we'll talk about that shortly. So the sorts of places where we want to do retries in Contoso, anytime we go and touch those databases, anytime we go and hit external services, when the orders API needs to access the service bus queue, if it fails, we'll retry. Has anybody used the transient fault handling application block? So there's a patterns and practices application block that gives you all the mechanism you need to do this smart retry logic. And then you just say, okay, here's the operation, retry 3 times, wait between 3 and 8 seconds, on failure, do this. Done. Easy, right? So the code's there for you, transient fault handling application block. That last thing I said was, after you've tried a few times, you may want to say, no, actually, this is a hard failure. This is what we call a circuit breaker pattern, and these two usually go together. So the circuit breaker pattern is, okay, this fault is enduring, I'm going to stop for a period. Because the last thing the person at the other end, you know, say it's an external web service, the last thing they want while they're trying to get it fixed is you hammering away at their service. So no, actually, we put the circuit breaker in. It's like the circuit breaker in your house, right? You plug something bad in the electricity socket, bang, the circuit breaker blows. What do? Retry. Bang, it blows again. Okay, retry. Bang, it blows again. Okay, I got a problem. Let me put that appliance to the side for a little bit and let me wait, see if it cools down, right? Because the appliance might have a problem. Okay, the appliance cools down, I'll retry again, bang. Okay, we'll let it cool down a little longer, all right? Plug it back in. Okay, great, now it's working again. So that's what you do with your circuit breaker pattern, right? If you're seeing lots of failures, because you're recording your failures, and you say, okay, that's too many failures, I'm going to stop retrying, and then I'm going to retry one request, say, every 20 seconds, until I see the service come back up, at which point I'll restart sending requests to it. So you'll usually combine that transient fault handling with a circuit breaker pattern. You know, so again, we'd probably have some of those sorts of things included in the points where we touch external services. One of the problems with a circuit breaker is that when you've tripped the circuit breaker, what do you do with the users? Right. A really important fundamental of fault handling in the cloud is if you don't have to fail the whole application, don't. Right? If the only thing that's broken, if we've tripped the circuit breaker here, that doesn't mean our whole orders API is offline. Equally, if we've tripped the circuit breaker here, there could be lots of data in the cache that we could keep on running the application. We just can't go and refresh the cache data. We can keep taking orders, right? The last thing we want to do is have a failed SQL server bring down the whole business and stop us from taking orders. So it's about using that circuit breaker to isolate failures. Again, if you think about your house, right, when you plug in the bad appliance and the circuit breaker trips, that's just one part of your house. Right? It's not your whole electricity system. You need to build your applications like that, where you can isolate these faults and only take down a portion of the application. There will be some times when you have critical functionality and you need to have a failover to some sort of additional system, right? If electricity is critical in your house, right, because you need to run your Xbox, what do you do? Buy a generator, right? Do you want to run the generator all the time? No, right? If the electricity fails, what do? Go out to the garage, start the generator, get the extension lead, plug it into the generator, go to the lounge, plug it into the television and the Xbox, right? And keep playing Xbox, right? So that is critical systems failover. So we go through our transient fault handling. We trip a circuit breaker, and that circuit breaker kicks off a process to fail over to some other system. And that other system could be another queue, or it could be a complete read-only replica of your entire application running in Hong Kong. It just depends on your requirements. Once we're asynchronous, dealing with faults is a whole lot easier. Once we're asynchronous, it's a whole lot easier not to notice that we have a problem. All right? Because we're over here putting messages on the queue, and this is broken, and we just don't notice it. All that happens is the queue is filling up. So one important thing with asynchronous approaches is you need to instrument them a whole lot more than you might otherwise, because you need to know what's going on where. So if we think about this, what sort of things might we want to do to deal with availability? There's a few things. Obviously, system A we deal with up here. The first thing we need to think about is, what if the queue fails? Some options there. We just have another queue. Try and put it in that queue. Did it work? No, retry. No, retry. No, retry. Okay, circuit breaker. Move to that queue. And this end just looks at this queue. Any messages in this queue? Yes, yes, yes. Oh, I can't even get to the queue. Okay, what about that queue? No, no, no. Yes, okay, now they're appearing in that queue. Right? And actually, you can make this distributed. Right? So you may want to put queues in different locations. Likewise, over here, you know, you may want to say, we'll handle system B, just dealing with standard transient faults, or actually we will have high availability on system B. So we may have a failover for system B. Again, where might Contoso use this? You know, probably the place that we'd want to use this is going to be here. Sensible things that we'd do, have some additional queues. Right? Things we probably don't want to do is stand up multiple BizTalk services environments. Things we're definitely not going to do is run multiple ERP systems. Right? You know, so at the end of the day, it's a business judgment that you're going to be making. Okay, so let's jump back. So you can see we've run our load test. Let's jump over here, and hopefully we can see that we scaled. That's a negative. Okay, so that's just a bug, I think. Stuff has changed since we wrote this content, so we'll need to go back and have a look at that. But what we'd want to see is that we've scaled when we've put it under load. I think what the challenge we've got here is that the Azure team have built websites and the auto-scale mechanism so that it doesn't scale for silly reasons, right? They've built it so it doesn't scale when you've got 5 users worth of load on it. Of course, we're here trying to say scale, scale, scale by doing our simple load test. We'll need to go fix that. Okay. So the next things to have a look at are caching. So again, let's browse the services. Let's have a look at Redis Cache. So you can see in here, we've got a Redis Cache. It's pretty simple. It's just Redis. And I've gone one step too quickly here. Yeah, we didn't see the website's auto-scaling. Yeah, so I mean, Redis Cache is just caching as a service. I can't reinforce how important putting caching in your applications is. I can't reinforce how much money it will save you in the cloud if you make sensible use of caching. Okay, so now we'll jump back to the old portal again. So you can see it's really easy to stand up the CDN. It's just a service in Azure.